Welcome back to the Preacher Podcast. We are in the season of Epiphany. Today, the seventh Sunday after the Epiphany, and Epiphany Moments is the theme of this worship series. I'm John Mitchell from Wisconsin Lutheran Seminary. With me through this series, Pastor John Calpine from Calvary in Dallas and Pastor Phil Huebner from Wisconsin Lutheran High School in Milwaukee. Phil, could we start with you? Could you brief us on the theme for the week in the Epiphany Moments series?
Sure, I'd be happy to do that. You mentioned well that this is the seventh Sunday after Epiphany. We've had these revelatory aha moments with Jesus, little by little revealing himself as the Christ, little by little showing his divine nature through miracles, and people have been flocking to him week after week. We've been tracing this, and the aha moments have been Jesus flipping things upside down on us. Last week, we started this little sermon chunk of Jesus with the blessings are our curses are blessings, as we were exploring Jesus' words. We looked at 2 Corinthians 12 last week, but Luke chapter 6 was the gospel. Now we pick up with that sermon text, Luke 6, 27. We're going to hear another very strange thing from Jesus, flipping something upside down, doing what the world would not expect of us, the big aha moment that we would love our enemies and overcome evil with good. And of course, we look to Christ as not only the ultimate example for that, but also the one who did it in our place and is our motivation for doing that. So that will be our big aha epiphany moment for this week, how we can show love to all, especially even our enemies.
Thank you, Phil. John, could you remind preachers of the other two readings for the day before we get to the gospel for our sermon text?
Sure, be happy to. Oftentimes there's prophecy and fulfillment. Back when the supplement came out, maybe a few more Old Testament lessons that were Bible history stories, and always good to get into those Bible history stories. So our Old Testament lesson from Genesis chapter 45 is a great example of what Jesus says put into practice already by Joseph. So Joseph was in a great position to get back at his brothers, to be as vindictive to them as they had been to him. But instead, he overcomes what had been evil on their part once upon a time with kindness and grace and mercy. And so it's Joseph revealing himself to his brothers, letting them know the person they've been bowing down to has been their brother. But there's no malice in him, but Joseph is kind and generous, going overboard to assure them of his mercy and forgiveness. And then there's a little something picked up in Genesis that Paul's going to pick up too, and that is there's a reason behind this, because God is in control and God has plans, and Joseph recognizes that all that happened was part of God's plan. This is the way it was supposed to be. And it ended them in this position where Joseph could be the one who would spare them from death in Canaan, but be able to preserve that remnant and preserve the line of the Savior. Then in Romans, very, very similar to the Luke reading, Paul mirroring many of the words of Jesus. But so this is Paul a little ways down, 30 years maybe or so down the pike, Paul under the Roman rule, but saying much the same thing. But again, here, Paul even gives us this a little bit more and says, especially in verse 19 of that reading, we leave room for God's wrath and vengeance. So we can do these things. We can live this upside down Christian life because we know that God's got a handle on these things, and whatever should or ought to be done, to the positive or the negative, he'll do it. And we can trust him to do it. And that frees us to live that kind of upside down Christian life, which then Jesus expresses so clearly in Luke's sermon on the plain, sermon on the mount, whichever name you give it there. But this stunning Christian ethic of the kindness, generosity, and mercy that we've been shown, that we then have opportunity to show in the lives of others.
Thank you. Excellent summaries. And let's then turn our attention to the gospel of the day, Luke 6, verses 27 through 38. Phil, could you get us started, maybe by suggesting to preachers tactics for approaching a text like this with so much in it? Or if you want to speak to that, and John, of course, if you'd like to give some thoughts on that as well. But that might be a good place to start, just an overall approach, Phil.
Yeah, let's first of all just take a step backwards and talk context. If we want to grab the context, we're going to talk about backing up to chapter 6, verse 12. One of those days, Jesus went to a mountainside to pray, and then he came down the next morning. It says, verse 17, he went down with them and stood on a level place. So that's where we have that title of Sermon on the Plain. And the context that it's not just 12 disciples, a large crowd of his disciples was there from all over Judea, Jerusalem, and the coastal region of Tyre and Sidon. So lots of people are there. We just heard the blessings and woes section. So now we jump in with this, I suppose, on the one hand, complicated section, because as you alluded to, John Mitchell, that there's so much here. He's just saying so many things, rapid fire, do this, do this, do this, do this, do this. And at the same time, very simple. Because you could perhaps say that the very first word that is in verse 27, or very first command, is what it's all about, love. I say to those who are hearing or who are listening, Jesus says, agapate, love, love your enemies. As for all these rapid-fire commands, as far as I could tell, I don't think I missed all 16 of these imperatives in the text, are in the present tense. So this is not just the, hey, really do a solid and love your enemy there one time, but fool me once, shame on you, that kind of thing. The next time, no, just keep going, keep loving, keep doing good, keep blessing, keep praying over and over and over again, present tense. One commentary, the Concordia commentary, breaks this up into three parts. Love your enemies, and then there's eight imperatives, including that one in the first section. Do good, bless, pray, turn the other cheek, give, don't demand, do to others, which we would maybe call the golden rule. Section two suggested is being like God, love your enemies by doing good and lending and being merciful. And then the English heading that we have about judging others, we are wrapping in verses 37 and 38 in this sermon text here for the gospel, which would be the third part, perhaps. Do not judge, do not condemn, forgive and give. So that would be eight imperatives, four imperatives, and four imperatives if you broke it up into three chunks. So I'll just say that to start with, other than how can you preach on every last thing? And I think if you picked out one or two or even all 16, you might leave someone out who maybe struggles with a different thing, a different sin. So maybe this is one of those where you talk about the concept of loving so perfectly, so selflessly. And the hearer can look at the list themselves. I mean, maybe you want to touch on some and give some specific examples, but this might be a case where you can just have an 80%, 20% law gospel balance if you just get after all these imperatives. So I think a word of caution there on how you pick and choose or summarize. But I'll pass over to the wisdom of you two, John and John, on how maybe you would approach all those present tense imperatives.
Yeah, John, thoughts on how to handle that?
So either I think, as Phil has suggested, you've maybe touched it a little bit more broadly, and you pick one or two, or you think of the concept in each of those imperative groups more broadly, or a preacher with freedom just says, "Here's the section I'm going to pick and choose. I'll take the first eight. I'll take the next four. I'll." And take that text and make it a little bit smaller for yourself. I think there is a lot of, the context is so important. Jesus preaching to his disciples, but this is really the sedes for Luther's understanding of the two kingdoms, and so there's got to be some preface there in approaching this so that you don't end up moralizing, but giving some understanding with which to approach these verses. And maybe you don't pick each one of the imperatives, but you give your hearers a way to approach these and what's a really good understanding of this section of this Sermon on the Mount, Sermon on the Plain. I think really it's going to be a beneficial homiletic approach to this text.
Right, Phil.
Maybe the words I would key in on one I mentioned already, which is the love part, right? Which is a good overarching summary of what Jesus is asking us to do. But also a word in the Greek that neither of us brought up quite yet. In English, Jesus is talking about loving your enemies and says, "Well, what credit is it to you if you?" And that interesting word credit, he actually uses the word charis in verses 33, and is it what 34 too, right? What credit is it to you? Charis, as we often commonly define, as undeserved love, grace, but also a gift, a benefaction, something that's bestowed on someone. And I think that would be an interesting concept to just think about, the undeserved love that Jesus is calling for. What kind of undeserved love, what kind of grace is it to give back to someone, or to do as been done to you, right? Even unbelievers do that kind of thing. What kind of undeserved love? But to show undeserved love even for those who persecute you and hate you and are your enemies. So maybe I would take the law. This is a long roundabout way of me saying, I think I would take the law maybe in this direction. My sinful nature absolutely despises what Jesus says here. I mean, just everything he says is so against what we do culturally, pretty much everywhere in the world, but especially in America, in cancel culture, in quick respond on X or Twitter platform, social media. This is just not what happens from the mean tweet to the bar fight when someone gets mad to boyfriend and girlfriend, husband and wife spats, and how you snap back at people to yelling at the checkout lady at Walmart because she's not checking out your groceries fast enough. My sinful nature despises every last word that Jesus says here because I absolutely hate it all and I don't want to do it. And so maybe I would focus a little on that aspect of it, of the law, that it's just so against our sinful nature to show this kind of love, or to use that word charis, to show that kind of undeserved love and grace.
Great, John.
And I think, Phil, that brings up such a good point, and not to get too dogmatic, but it's maybe not something we often preach on or point out, but you're really talking about not the committing of sins, but the lack of love. And here's a really great place to narrow in on what I think in front of our congregations really is a weakness, and that is not so much sins of commission, but sins of omission. And the love that Christ encourages, or if you take the second part, different word, the mercy that he encourages is something I'd prefer to omit. I don't want to do that good thing that Jesus encourages. And that goes back to our theme, right? Overcoming evil with good. And I'd rather just omit that. And maybe don't always feel quite so bad about it. At least I didn't commit a sin. Who cares that I didn't do the good? And this kind of nails us to the wall. No, we don't get to get a pass and say, well, I just didn't do the good. Yeah, no, that's equally as much of a failure in God's sight. And this, yeah, this is not a word my sinful nature wants to hear.
Yeah, I think of real life example when 9/11 happened, and I just remember I was in college at the time. I remember seeing video footage the next day of people in the Middle East, burning American flags and jumping up and down and cheering at what had taken place in our country and the attack. And I just, how many Americans had the thought of, let's go to war right now and take care of this? And how many Americans said, I sure hope the gospel reaches their hearts with all that evil. I'm going to pray for them and pray that God blesses them and that God spares their souls for those who have hatred in their hearts and who help plan this. And this is just, as we're saying, this is just so foreign to what we experience on a daily basis. And maybe for the preacher, just a quick, simple illustration of that, like I shared, can just hit it home on that this is just not what we do. And boy, it's so easy to fail on every aspect. And the present tense concept too. Like it's hard enough to do one time, but then to
Much less.
keep doing all of these things, to keep praying, keep blessing, and wow, that's difficult. And even if it's not my enemy, maybe it's the person who lives in my house with me. I mean, wow, it's difficult to forgive my spouse. I know I'm difficult to forgive for my spouse, but to forgive my wife and my children and do it over and over and over again. And those are people I love. how much harder for my neighbor that hates me.
John?
I think you asked at the beginning how might we take a big text and focus a little bit more narrowly. You have two pretty big statements in here that a lot of the world knows, and that might be a way. You've got the golden rule. It's in here. Do to others as you would have them do to you. So that you might say, I'm going to focus on that because that's something people know. You also have do not judge and you will not be judged, which is maybe one of the most misused passages in the scripture. And so the lectionary has offered you these verses to address. And so maybe rather than all of the 16 imperatives, I think you could spend a good 20 minutes, 10 minutes on each, just saying, you know, we got a couple of biggies here. And these are scriptural. Yes, the golden rule is ultimately it's in the scriptures. Let's talk about it. Yes, the scriptures do say, don't judge and you won't be judged. How do we understand that properly? And I think that would be a way where you could spend a fair amount of time really delving into something that's right in front of you. That I think would also be satisfying to people.
Yeah, good suggestion. I think, yeah, these are verses that people know. They've been quoted or maybe misquoted so often. Misapplied might be a good strategy to zero in on a couple of those. A couple other thoughts re related to the malady. One common thought that I see kind of running through Jesus' commands here is our sinful flesh. And its desire to do good only when some good is coming back. I'll do something good for you if and only if I can get something out of it, kind of the what's in it for me attitude. And if that's not there, well, then why would I bother to do it? So in a lot of these, you kind of see Jesus saying, no, I'm commanding you to do good even when nothing good is going to come back to you, at least not very soon. Maybe in eternity, but not right away. John?
Yeah, there's some precious gospel in that Christ does for us expecting nothing in return, and for us too. You know, I think people, when I teach a confirmation class, I kind of set them up for it, but so you avoided something because you didn't want to threaten a punishment. They understand that's law. When I say to them, no, you did something because you got a goodie, that's gospel. Oh, yeah, no, yeah, that's gospel. No, that's equally law.
Right.
That I'm still selfishly trying to get something out of it for myself is a motivation just as law-based. That precious gospel that says there is nothing in it for me, and that's okay. That is how Christ dealt with me, with that kind of mercy. So that's a fine point there, John, to point out.
Yeah. And one more thought, I kind of noticed this, especially in that last section, but I think you see traces of it in the earlier sections too. And that is our sinful nature's double standard. I should be treated well, but enemies, other people who ask things of me, I don't need to treat them well. And here you have, the golden rule speaking to that in verse 31. Jesus kind of blows up that idea. The judge not section, and with the measure you use, it will be measured to you. So, it might be another avenue for a malady related thought. Just our tendency to treat others in one way, because they don't deserve as much good. Meanwhile, we just assume, well, of course we do. I do deserve something good. When in fact, it's all mercy all the time. By which all of us live. And I think Jesus has a way of bringing that out here and kind of leveling the playing field in a way. Moving toward the gospel, well, what do you do in a section like this where it is so heavily law? I see a couple spots we could jump off of, and I know we've mentioned a couple already. Phil, you've mentioned the charis there, and any other suggestions you would have for preachers for focusing on the gospel. Phil?
Well, you mentioned the word charis, so I'll go off of that springboard with that. And I know we normally do this toward the end of our little recording here, but I was just thinking sermon text themes, and I haven't preached on this text yet, but I wonder if I would maybe consider a play on words a little bit. In 32, 3 and 4, as I had mentioned, he uses that word charis, and Jesus says, poia charis, what kind of grace, what kind of credit is that to you? And I think of the Lent hymn, What Grace Is This? Maybe that would be my sermon theme. What grace is this? And maybe just a little rumination on what in the world is Jesus asking us to do? Like, what extent of love, what extent of grace? I'm not going to recapitulate all the law we just talked about, but springing forward to now the gospel side, wow, what unbelievable grace is this that we see in our Savior? And I sure hope, preachers, that we first of all consider these 16 present imperatives and take opportunity to preach active obedience of Christ, because we see just how impossible it is. I mean, how can we not be slapped in the face with how miserably we fail repeatedly, and that our perfect, we need a savior, a substitute who could do it in the present imperative all the time without fail, never once in my place. And secondly, what great opportunities to layer then on the passive obedience, the passion of Christ. And I hope preachers take us right to Holy Week, because while there's a lot of opportunities, right? The very thing Jesus asks us to do, he in fact does. Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. Love your enemies. Turn the other cheek. Spit on, beat, all the things of his passion. Being merciful and doing good, despite how he was ridiculed and rejected, despite taking all of our guilt and shame upon himself, forgiving. Right, all the things that he asks us to do, not only did he do perfectly, but he paid for, and that we see in his passion that he did for us to pay for the wages of our sins with death. So, what awesome opportunities to preach what Christ has done, I think, with this text.
Great. John, other gospel ideas?
Yeah, it's right there in verse 35, because he, referencing back to the Most High, he is kind to the ungrateful and the wicked. And I don't like to admit that I'm all these evil things to him, but how gospel-centered it is that he is all these things to me. And I am ungrateful and I'm wicked, but he has been kind. He's been generous. He has forgiven. He's done all these things, and it means my salvation. It means I am forgiven, and he has overcome my evil, not with evil, not by getting me back, but he overcame my evil with the ultimate goodness. We even call it the gospel, which is not the evil news or the bad news. It's the good news. He was just so, and continues to be so good, kind, gracious, and generous to me. In all these things, he fulfills for me.
Yeah, I would echo that too. And I was thinking of the verse right after the one you mentioned, John. Also, be merciful, and then the second part of that verse, just as your Father is merciful, which is kind of an saying the same thing as the end of verse 35. And that's a beautiful gospel thought. And that verse, in fact, reminds me of other verses like Jesus' words in John 15. Love each other as I have loved you. So there's an imperative followed up by some beautiful gospel, as I have loved you. Or is it Ephesians, Colossians, forgive as you have been forgiven. So imperatives, but right behind and fueling the imperative is the gospel truth, God's grace toward us. And so you see those popping out also. Further thoughts for preachers about how to either bring out law gospel, how to apply these words in an evangelical way, Phil?
Yeah, I think there's, the general thing on, like we talked about it, my sinful nature struggles with this, and we can go down the whole list of wow, it's hard to love your enemies and all this kind of thing. But I think we should also take into consideration how very personal some of these things are for people. And if we're wrapping in the other readings that we're considering, Romans 12. I think of a dear member of mine in the past who just had all the tears coming down her cheeks because of how her husband was wrongfully fired from his job that he was very good at and was maltreated and all the hardship that came to their family. Or especially, wow, especially Joseph and his brothers. I mean, there are people, preachers included, but there are members of ours who are just so hurt. The good and godly mother whose brother abused the niece. I mean, just how could I forgive that? How could you do this to me? So to just to consider, I think it's more than just love your enemies, because those enemies have names and have faces in our lives and in our experiences. And for us to think that who's your enemy? Really, everyone's my enemy. And in fact, I'm an enemy of God, because sin separates us from each other, and sin separates us from God. And just to see the incredibly powerful love of Jesus for all, hopefully can be not only the healing and binding up of my own heart, but then in how I look to other people. If I can recognize that I am an enemy with so many millions of sins that have been washed clean and forgiven, can that then that can that gospel empower me to show that kind of love in the most difficult situations, like Paul calls for in Romans, like Joseph did with his brothers? It's just so personal for all of us. So if the gospel becomes personal to me, hopefully then application in how I live my life, it can be personal in my relationships with my neighbor.
Right, John?
If preachers want just a something a little bit more objective, but a real life situation, and it happened right here in Dallas. A young man was killed by a police officer coming home late. Was in the wrong apartment and thought she was in hers, and she was in his apartment, and ended up killing him. His name was Botham Jian. That was the man who was killed. So his brother's on the stand. And you hear this, he's got a chance to speak, and you hear this so often, the opposite of what Jesus says. People, I hope you get the worst, and I hope you rot, and it's just their chance for that vengeance. And he stood there and said, I forgive you. I want nothing more for you than to know Jesus. And then in a stunning move, asked the judge, could I come down and give this person that killed his brother, can I give her a hug? And you see that on the video. This was Luke 6 in action. And I think to myself, would I have been able to do that? He even says, I didn't talk to my family about this, and I don't know that they agree, but that's stunning. And the reaction of the world was, we don't get this. We don't understand how you could do this. But that's a real life example. I think an application, I had referenced it before, the two kingdoms. If you have volume 21 of Luther's works on the Sermon on the Mount, it'd be good to do read through this. This is a section where Jesus is talking to the Christian as Christian, not the Christian in relationship to others, like a parent. I know it somebody comes into my house as dad, I may not turn the other cheek. I'm going to defend my family. If I'm a judge, I am going to have to judge. If I'm a soldier, there are things I'm asked to do. So just getting an understanding of what this means in terms of I'm talking to Christian just as Christian. And sometimes I have relations that may offer different solutions. But Christian as Christian, this is how I want to live. I also think of I think it was somebody asked Gandhi once what he thought of Christianity. This, I think, a somewhat famous phrase. I'm not going to quote it exactly. But he said, "Your Christ I like." And that we see in the gospel section of this of these words. This is Christ. This is what he did. But then Gandhi went on to say, "Your Christians, maybe not so much." And this is a standard we find difficult to live up to because we still wrestle with our sinful flesh. Nonetheless, Jesus' words are true. He didn't say, "Oh, by the way, I was just kidding. I know none of you can do this." No, this is that standard by which, as Christian, I want to live and reflect that love.
Yeah, beautiful thoughts. But Phil?
Yeah, maybe that's part of the epiphany aha moment that Jesus asks us to do the most ridiculous things, and as I said sort of at the beginning, like just flips everything upside down from what our world would say. But for the Christian, it also flips upside down my perspective of these verses. So on the one hand, I look at this and like, no way, never, my sinful nature doesn't want to, there's no way I could match up to that. But the gospel flips it upside down and now empowers me to look at this and say, what opportunity I have. Wow, am I free to do what no one else does, to do what's unthinkable, like John's wonderful and heartwarming story from the courtroom. What opportunity I can be the mask of Christ to show this kind of light and love in a world filled with sinful darkness. So yeah, the aha, whoa, Jesus just turns this backwards on me that do this, do this. No, I get to do this. I get to be Christ to the world. And what an empowering thing it is to be filled with his love and then spill out his love toward others.
Yeah, I was thinking along similar lines too, kind of the radical change in perspective that Jesus' love to us gives on these words. We mentioned it before when we were talking about the malady. Yeah, these words, the law always accuses the flesh. And yeah, boy, these words really do accuse our flesh too. But then when you're enveloped by the love and mercy and forgiveness that Jesus gives, covered with his righteousness, the perspective is completely altered. And here it is. Well, what else am I going to do but love as I have been loved? What else would I do but be merciful as my God is merciful to me? So totally changes our perspective on things. Further thoughts, or we can get into if you have ideas for themes for this section, or central thoughts, could share those with preachers. Any ideas to share? John?
There's a lot of different ways that you can go with some themes. Here are just some that popped to my mind. If you're going to kind of go with the golden rule there, do unto others, you might go with something along the line, Christianity is the gold standard. And you might just delve into the fact that really, this is something that just almost every religion has. But only Christianity really has the empowerment, like Phil just so wonderfully spoke about, the empowerment to actually live the gold standard. So this is something you see across all religions, but Christianity really, it's the only one that really gets it and has the means and the motivation to do it. If you want to go with mercy, I would say I have followed the path of mercy, and so mercy is the key point. But all the little different commands are the pathway of mercy. And then maybe something along the line of, Phil's pointed out, love really is the overarching theme. But then it's how do you live love? So love in action, right? Love is just it's a word, overused word. But here now we have 16 imperatives that say, here's how you put love into action. And then maybe a final one that maybe wraps the whole thing up, dare to be different. These are any one of these imperatives, each of the three sections that Phil outlined for us are something that's entirely different to what comes naturally. So those are a few thoughts that I've had about directions for thematic ideas.
Okay, great. Phil?
Yeah, my inductive version. I think I tip my hat on that one. I love to do an inductive play on, that word grace. What grace is this? So the law section, like, what kind of thing is he asking me to do here? It's unimaginable. And then what grace is this that he shows to me? And then, wow, what grace is this that I get to show to my neighbor? So that'd be more an inductive reflection. If I did a more deductive version, maybe my title would be something like Unthinkable or Unimaginable Love. And my three parts perhaps would be, love that's okay, boring, law, gospel application, but unthinkable love, love that's required, love that's redeeming, and love that's restoring in my relationships with my neighbor, or love that's forgiving, love that's freeing, or something if you want to have some kind of alliteration or whatever. But I guess that general flow is probably how I would take a sermon.
Yeah, I was thinking of John mentioned keying off of mercy, and verse 36, again, just kind of gets my attention. Be merciful just as your Father is merciful. So you could work with something like see or recognize the Father's mercy. First of all, coming to us. And there you could, talk about how all these commands just we see how far we fall short in every single one of them. But then see the Father's mercy coming to us in his forgiveness. And then after that, see the Father's mercy flowing through us or something like that, where that our perspective on these is transformed by the mercy he shows us. Related to that, kind of if preachers have worked with a Lowry loop type of format where you the first part of the sermon, you kind of really delve into the conflict and complication. This could work as we were talking about before, how as I just mentioned, also you could just talk about how all these commands, so beautiful, so well regarded, even non-Christians will adopt the golden rule. But how can such beautiful commands just burden us so and accuse us so terribly? What if, though, something new entered the picture that was not just our actions? And that is the mercy, the grace of God coming to us. And that flips things around, forgives us, gives us new life. And then the consequences that flow out of that are, trying to enact these words that Jesus gives us and reflect his mercy to others. So that might be a suggestion. John?
It would seem that this whole series sets you up for, if you're experimenting with the Lowry loop, right? Part of the whole concept of the Lowry loop was that aha moment. Well, you've got a whole series of aha moments that maybe sets you up really well. I don't do a whole lot of how-to sermons, but as I studied this, I thought this is a great sermon on, I have difficult people in my life. How do I deal with difficult people? Here's Jesus' ethic, here's his advice. And so maybe a theme, if you want to give just the application, give it away right up front. Today's a sermon on how to deal with difficult people. You got enemies, you got people taking advantage of you, you got people that are being awfully judgy. All right. How do you deal with them? And in each of the imperatives is giving you a way to deal with them that doesn't come naturally, but is obviously part of the love of Christ.
So very practically oriented sermon. Just what do we do with these words? Showing that in light of the love of Christ. Yeah, these are things that actually would bring joy to people and honor to the Father as his love works through us and in us. Any final thoughts? Other reflections for preachers? Okay, if not, then let's turn it over to them. Preachers, enjoy working with this text, wrestling with these words, but most of all, seeing the grace and mercy of Jesus that is ours in Christ. And is ours to share with one another and even our enemies.